Our reading in the Gospel of Matthew this week is in chapter 8, so if you grab your Bible, make your way over to there. We'll talk a little bit about Matthew chapter 8. We finished up the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
5, 6, and 3 weeks
there.
5, 6, and 7. And maybe it would be a good place to remind folks, I just say this because Jeff likes it when I say it, don't be bound by the chapter.
Right, think across the chapters.
Divisions, yes. So it might be helpful to remember that at the end of the sermon, the summary on Jesus is the crowd's astounded
right,
because he taught with authority and not like the scribes, which I think is an idea that Matthew's going to keep playing with
right,
beyond chapter 7. So in chapter 8, really, in fairness, in chapter 8 and 9, what we have are a lot of miracles. You're going to be reading a lot of miracle stories. There's like a collection of
right,
them going on here. And so from one angle, I think it's really easy to look at the miracles as this kind of low-hanging fruit, easy to say, oh, it's a miracle section, right?
Right.
And
but I think about the significance of it.
Yeah, and to focus on that. But I think the miracles are saying something bigger and deeper. So
sure,
maybe that's what we need to work with as we look at this segment, not just the dramatic expression of his power that we obviously see with his miracles, right? But what the deeper point is that the miracles are trying to make. So if you just look through the text, we have a leopard cleansed, and then the centurion servant healed, then Peter's mother-in-law,
right,
and then the demon cast out, then the storm calmed, and then demon cast out again. So by my count, that's what, 6 miracles
yeah,
in this chapter, with a little interlude discussion about discipleship
mm-hmm,
in the middle of that. So obviously dramatic demonstration of the power of Jesus
yeah,
in a lot of different ways here.
Right. And I think we're encouraging people to read across the chapters. One of the things that structures Matthew is, we didn't talk about this before, I don't think in any of the other episodes, Matthew kind of has Jesus's teaching kind of caught in the 5 major sections, 5 major discourses. The Sermon on the Mount is the first one. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that happens, you're reading Matthew, if you want to read Matthew as Matthew and get kind of what Matthew's up to, Matthew kind of alternates these long sections of Jesus's teaching, Sermon on the Mount being the first one in the book, within sections of stories that in some way are meant to kind of provide comment on or demonstration over some aspect of, some implication of the discourse in the vicinity. And so here, to your point, David, you end with, he has authority, and now you have a bunch of miracles that demonstrate authority in some sort of way. And so it's certainly manifesting his power, but power to what end? It's kind of, you don't have to pick between power and authority in one sense. One implies the other.
Right.
And so, but he begins to demonstrate that. And so it's an interesting, Matthew being Matthew, how this works, even again, by the Holy Spirit, there are intentional choices made here about what stories to put in, where to put them in, when to put them in.
And if I could pause and say, I think that's really important to remember.
Yeah.
Even as we read any segment of the Gospels, to bear in mind what John said at the end of his Gospel, how many other things could have been included? More stories, more teaching. And so the ones we're reading were selected. And I think in the case of Matthew, selected and placed in sequence.
Absolutely.
For a reason and for a purpose.
Sure.
I don't know that we dive that deeply typically when we work with the text. We just look at the list of miracles that happens here and don't appreciate, but maybe these are here and in this order for a reason. And
absolutely,
I think that's what you're alluding to.
No, that's thank you for putting it much better than I just did. That's exactly right. So Matthew leads with a cleansing of a leper. A hopeless illness, and in particular one that spreads, lepers can't touch, lepers are outside. Leprosy was an apt metaphor for sin, and so part of why the Levitical law dealt with it that way. And so literally Matthew opens with for the law of Moses minded, hearer, listener, reader, something that metaphorically very much stood in for sin being removed. It separates you and it's contagious. Which then leads to the centurion story in which—
Before you leave it, though.
Yeah.
I just wanted to grab that language in verse 3 because it ties exactly to what you were saying.
Uh-huh.
Jesus reaches out—
And touches him.
and touches him.
That's right.
And it's such a beautiful metaphor for what Jesus has literally come to do, to grab the sinner and rescue the sinner,
right?
Beset with the terrible disease.
Well, and to use even the Law of Moses type language, whereas usually sin / disease was unclean and contagious, I touch you, you get it from me. This is God's power and God's authority, where instead when he touches you, he doesn't get diseased, you get healed. It's like a complete reversal of the human condition when God comes to save you.
Yeah.
And so it's powerful when you begin to think through what's kind of being demonstrated there, and seemingly just, Jesus has power to do miracles. No, why this one? Why here? Why, what's it really communicating? But then it gets, more personal, having kind of very much in the Jewish mode, had a very symbolically significant miracle, the centurion, who would most likely be a Gentile. Comes to Jesus and explains the reason he's dealing with Jesus the way he does is he recognizes in Jesus authority. And so kind of like in other gospels, the first person to confess, or the first being in the case of a demon, but the first entity to confess Jesus in a meaningful way in many gospels is not somebody who should have been expecting and looking for him. It's a demon, or in this case, a centurion, who's the first to say, I get who you are. and that's why I'm going to deal with you this way, which leads Jesus to talk about the nature of the kingdom. What's the sermon been about? The nature of the kingdom. And so this centurion recognizing in Jesus' authority.
Right.
Jesus then immediately says, yep. So the kingdom's going to be full of surprises now as we're starting to actually get out and mingle with people.
Yeah, and watch that word carrying through, because that's at the end of 7 when he finishes up the Sermon on the Mount,
exactly.
Right? As one having authority.
Yeah.
And now here is the Gentile as the one seeing the authority of Jesus. And maybe it's important for us just to throw that in, not to add too many cooks in this kitchen, but it's interesting that Matthew, in this gospel that feels very Jewish, is the one that keeps talking about the Gentiles and keeps giving us Gentile hints, which I think is really
important.
And
that God intends to bring them in. God intends to include them. And that's even Jesus' warning. Jesus' warning is actually for the sons of the kingdom, for the Jews here, in verse 12, especially when the sons of the kingdom to be thrown in the outer darkness. He's warning his Jewish brethren that the centurion's ahead of you on this, and you better figure this out.
Right. Well, and two outsiders, the leper and the centurion in their own ways.
Yeah, that's right.
Would have been outsiders to the community that Jesus is literally reaching out to.
Right, and these are the guys who get to experience some aspect of the kingdom or be aware of the kingdom and its real essence is, first and foremost. And so verse 14 through 16 then, or 17,
Peter's mother-in-law.
Yeah, which just further, and it summarizes also with casting out the demons and stuff like that. That basically, so here's Jesus then to drive out this uncleanness. So but again, who's going to recognize and who's going to receive the benefit of it? Then a bit on discipleship. Again, maybe why the sons of the kingdom won't get in. They don't recognize, the kingdom is not all glory and benefits at first. It's a way of suffering and self-denial. Because the king himself is going to be somebody who has nowhere to lay his head for a while and some things like that.
Yeah, that is interesting. To sort of lay that alongside the points that have been making about his authority, I almost wonder.
Yeah, it is interesting.
If that's meant to say, we've been building him up. Here's the king. Here's the one with authority.
Right.
But he doesn't look like a king.
Right.
He didn't have a place to put his head down.
That's exactly right.
So it's almost a contrast there. Again, challenging, I think, the perceptions they have of who the guy is going to be.
Right.
May not be who you're expecting.
That's exactly right. But then the next miracle that's there, this is the interesting one, because it's not about healing somebody or fixing something. It's about a raw demonstration of power and authority, the power over the sea that literally leaves his disciples in shock. What sort of man is this? And that's the thing, because you have to understand in the ancient world, the sea was the final frontier, right? It wasn't space. It was the sea.
And they were not seafaring people like others around them.
No. And what we take for granted now, because we have these great, naval nuclear-powered vessels or steam-powered, diesel-powered ships that go out in the open ocean. Most ancient sea traffic, not all, but most, was actually hugged the coast. And that's why it took, even sailing took a long time. They'd hug the coast. They wouldn't go too far outside of land, even when they went on the Mediterranean, because, people sailed out into the middle of the open sea and they never came back. And that was the thing, too, is there was no satellite tracking or something. Then people sailed out in the ocean and never came back, and you never knew what happened to them.
And by the way, there's a lot of dark sea imagery in the Old Testament.
Big time.
And I think that we miss that.
That's right.
When we read the New.
That's right.
But that would have been in the mind of the original readers of this.
That's right.
When you brought up the sea,
yeah,
and being out on the sea in a storm, that I think conjured up different fears and dread than it would in me and you.
That was, in their world, the ultimate power of nature. Kind of like today, we talk about, you know, one of nature's ultimate powers is even more than a tornado, is a hurricane.
Right.
There's, you know, which comes from the sea.
Right.
Even still to this day, one of the most powerful forces on our planet that we recognize all our technology, we just see it coming now, but it's the hurricane. And so for them, yes, this was the ultimate, you know, nature broken, putting human life in danger, the ultimate power of nature, and in a miracle that's just absolutely unheard of. You know, other prophets may have done some healings, but, you know, the closest is when Moses parted the sea, but even that's ultimately depicted as God parting the sea. Yeah. And so they're shocked. You know, this is no ordinary prophet even. Something different is at work here. And is this, you know, what sort of man? That's the whole point. He's more than a man.
Yeah, and I feel like as we go through the miracles, we're advancing and it's becoming more dramatic because
that's right.
You know, you start out with the centurion that's got leprosy, which is a hopeless disease. And then, I'm sorry, not the centurion, but the leper.
The leper, yeah.
And then you had the centurion and you have the Gentile now, it's reaching out to him, and we allude to demon possession, which now it's going from human beings to the spirit world,
right.
And now we go beyond humans, and we have the very forces of nature that are under the command of this one,
command.
Yes, and I almost. This is totally baiting Jeff, but I'm admitting it. Are we supposed to see Genesis here?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think you're supposed to see Genesis, but even more, you know, this is, you know, in one sense, fallen creation now, because now it's not under man's dominion in a sense, like, you know, in Genesis. And so you see, this is language that you really see in the Psalms and in Isaiah, in which in some of the Psalms, and especially in Isaiah, God showing, you know, when God is kind of declaring to his people, you have no idea how powerful I really am.
Yeah.
You know, it's like in Isaiah when he talks about, you know, Leviathan, the sea monster, the sea creature is my plaything, you know, and then smoting Leviathan, just, you know, all the powers of the sea, the mystery, the fearfulness of it. And it's just, it's a toy, it's a trifle to me.
Right.
And so that's the thing is, you know, so for again, for just like we started with leprosy being a very specifically chosen disease out of the Mosaic mindset for Jesus to open with in Matthew's gospel. The same thing here for the Jewish mindset who's steeped in Psalms and prophets. In the fallen world, there's nothing more fearsome to humanity than the open sea.
Yeah.
And even though it's the Sea of Galilee, the point is they were at risk of dying, and they were powerless and impotent in the face of it. And, you know, and what sort of man is that even the wind and the seas obey him? This is an act of utter power and authority that makes even other things that other prophets may have done something similar to up to a point pale in comparison.
And then we have, finally, the casting out of the demons and the power over the ruler of the demons, ultimately.
The frightening unseen realm that was also a realm beyond human power and control, and even comprehension, because you can't see this as such. And, you know, the man is demon-possessed, but you don't see the demons as such. And so that's the thing. And we forget sometimes. We forget, and this is important as well, that— You know, John talks about this in 1 John, for this reason, the Son of God was made manifest or appeared that he might destroy the works of the devil. That the, you know, that in one very real sense, the coming of Jesus was not to condemn man as such. It was to achieve the forgiveness of our sins. It was to crush the serpent's head. It was to make war on the devil himself. And so I think that's the other part that's powerful about this starting from the beginning here is this is Jesus come to make war on Satan for human salvation, to, again, deliver man not just from disease, but from what really, you know, is even more kind of significant underneath disease, or what disease is just a metaphor, for the spiritual forces of darkness, for Satan, for sin, for temptation, from death. And so now he comes to deliver man from literally that which really oppresses him, the spiritual forces of darkness.
I was thinking back to what you said a minute ago about the calming of the seas and about how everyone and everything bows the knee to Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, as we go through this section, you know, disease bows the knee to Jesus, and then the sea bows the knees to Jesus, and then the adversary bows the knee to Jesus. And I wonder if maybe a takeaway, I even wonder if this is something parents could talk to their kids about, is that when we read the stories, the question maybe underneath that is, what about me and you?
Right.
Everything else God made bows the knee to Jesus.
That's right.
do we bow the knee to Jesus? Do we honor his authority? Which gets us back to the very end of Matthew 7, where we just were.
Right.
Where you heard the sermon.
Right.
Will you do what he said?
Oh, that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the most powerful takeaways. And the other thing is, for the most part, you know, the least likely in our eyes are actually the most likely to recognize him. You know, the demons confess him. You know, what do you have to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come to torment us before the time? The demons know who he is. And the centurion, the oppressive Roman centurion knows who he is. But his own people, those who are most religious are least likely to recognize him and bow the knee. Isn't that interesting?
Perhaps the others are not clouded by their presuppositions of who they want him to be.
Well, that's a humbling thing to think about. When you've already got a template that the Messiah has to meet.
Yeah. So. When you read with your kids this week, and this is a great segment to read with the kids. You know, the miracle stories.
Oh, the kids can identify with this.
Yeah, are exciting.
Yeah.
But don't forget what's underneath that, and that is the authority and right of Jesus to rule. Everyone else bows to Jesus, and like we learned at the end of the sermon, so should we too.